Welcome to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. Well, how did Matt and Ted Lee become the country's favorite evangelistic team for the religion of Southern foods and cooking? And I hope they're going to tell us how all that came about, because both of them are my guest as we talk about their latest book, The Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen. Matt and Ted, welcome.
DG, thanks for having us.
You guys have so many fans in Chapel Hill and the Research Triangle area. I mean, is that true all over the country, or is it mostly North and South Carolina, mostly the South? Where's the fan base?
We started life in Charleston. I think that's where most people hate us, but we are
controversial in our own home.
No. All right, now we got.
I'm
just
overstating the case, but
all right, now forget my first question there, yes. Because they hate you in Charleston.
No. I just mean that the idea of two Charleston boys going to around the country popularizing boiled peanuts is inherently a little bit controversial. You know, boiled peanuts should not travel. Everyone knows they are delicious. There's no explaining that needs to be done. You know, there's just a certain amount of, protectionism going on in Charleston because we've got it so good from a food standpoint.
And, they don't want to share?
Well, they've gotten handy about sharing in the last 100 years because of the whole tourism industry is the number one industry in Charleston. It's, we made it our mission just to put a finer point on how brilliant Charleston's food culture is and how diverse and rich the sources of inspiration, whether it's the ingredients or the traditions or just the characters behind the food. So this newest book is really all about that. It's about us digging in deep, having the luxury to write essays within the context of what's, regular cookable cookbook, essays about, subjects that interested us. The tradition of spring tea rooms in the churches in Charleston is one example. The visit of this celebrity food writer, Clementine Paddleford, to Charleston in the 40s, Ted?
51,
okay. A lot of things seem to happen in Charleston in 1951. Anyhow, whether it's old or new, we were interested in digging into what Charleston's food life had to say.
Well, just back to the original, there was an offhand remark that you made that they hate us.
Yeah.
So there was nothing in there that
you want to probe that.
Yeah,
don't
I want to probe that.
Okay.
Or was that you?
We can do that
because it's. I guess where we started was where you're popular, and then you say you got me off track by saying we're hated in the place where I bet you you're really the most popular, and that is in your hometown. Where
Matt was exaggerating, but I do think there's part of that. Being an evangelist for Charleston. There are a lot of people who want to keep it a secret. we have it good in Charleston, and there are a lot of people who just feel like it should be unto itself, and we appreciate that. We grew up there. We know what it's like, and we know how special a place it is. But I think another part of that may be the fact that, for our peers, we grew up in Charleston. It's our home. It's where we learned to cook. But Matt and I were actually, we came from New York City and moved there.
Dun, 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 dun.
So there's a little resentment about your leaving Charleston and then coming back?
No, about not being from there. Our parents are not Charlestonians. They are New Yorkers.
You were born there, but you've got to be there for multiple generations before you can be a real Charleston.
Oh, gosh. Nina Pinta Santa Maria.
So here's how it happened. We got to Charleston when I was 7 and Matt was 9. And I think that really is the real germ of what we've become, because when we got to Charleston, there was a lot of from New York. I mean, you have to understand, we left during the Summer of Sam. All my memories of New York City when I was a child have to do with anxiety and fear of being kidnapped and the street and all that kind of stuff. Just terror. Hot town, summer in the city. And then we arrive in Charleston where, in those days, South Broad, everyone left their door open. We didn't lock the door. We had the Hazel V. Parker playground across the street. There were mulberry trees. There were loquat trees.
There's porpoises in the harbor outside our bedroom window. There's Chuck Will's widows, tweeting in the magnolia trees. I mean, it's really the softest, kindest, subtropical environment, and the antithesis of, you know, the hard cities.
So you loved it, but the people in Charleston were fine. You're fine, but you're just not of us. Is that sort of the...
No, I mean, I don't think that Charlestonians, when we moved there, were, you know, we already had friends from, my parents had friends who had introduced them to Charleston, and they were real local. And they, you know, their family had been there for ages, and they completely embraced us, showed us all these things that we didn't know as kids from New York. You know, we didn't know how to tie a string around a chicken neck and throw it off a dock and catch blue crab. We didn't know how to throw a cast net. We'd never shucked an oyster. And kids our age, you know, 7 and 9 years old, they'd all done that. They had all this knowledge that related to food that we didn't, that we needed to catch up on. And I think that's where the sense of wonder that we bring to Charleston's food culture even today comes from.
We preserve that sense of being that 7 year old in from New York and just being endlessly amazed and delighted and excited about the potential of this place, especially as pertains to food. So we caught up fast. And the great thing about Charleston is, you know, you may not be from there, born and bred, but if you show Charlestonians that you can party as hard as they do and engage the culture as deeply as they do, they welcome you in. And in fact, in our research, we found that this has been going on for centuries.
Wow. Well, all right. Now I'm ready to go back to my original question.
Okay.
And that is, where is the fan base? You know, you got it here in Chapel Hill. You got a lot of friends.
Well, we love this area, and we just try to make friends wherever we go, naturally. But from the start, you know, we got to start writing about food and travel for a national audience. And I think for Travel and Leisure magazine back in 2000, they asked us to write a South Carolina story, and that was our lucky break. Got us out of the, you know, not out of the boiled peanuts. We still do that, but you know, it diversified our portfolio from boiled peanuts to writing about food, which was a huge leap. And that magazine goes out to 1 million+ people every month. So
you got to know a audience across the country.
And engaging in sort of like a more national discussion about food. We then started writing freelance for the New York Times, the food section on Wednesdays, which involved not only writing and interviewing and, you know, acting as a journalist, but also developing recipes in your home test kitchen to accompany those stories. And that was a wonderful experience for us and really helped set us up for the cookbook process, which is very much about that.
I keep getting you all to answer questions and said, okay, that reminds me. But a lot of people don't realize that your basic business is peanuts. And you mentioned that you...
Boil it down to the peanuts, yes.
And that's a story in itself, I think, that...
We might not have time for that one today.
You know, you say there's no way, you know, that boiled peanuts are always good, but that's not true. I mean, because you can mess them up if you do it wrong and you're not fresh and everything. What got you, what made you think that people in other parts of the country would like boiled peanuts?
After college, you know, we grew up in Charleston. We both went to colleges in the Northeast, but we'd come back to Charleston every break because we missed it and we were homesick, and we were homesick especially for the foods of Charleston that had become so much a part of our lives. And that it was during, after college, we both moved to New York thinking we would get, you know, quote unquote normal jobs. I wanted to be in publishing, Matt wanted to use his art history degree to work in the auction houses, and we weren't finding much luck finding jobs, and at the same time we were deeply homesick. It was the blizzard of 1994, and we thought, well, dang, if we could find some raw peanuts and boil them up, wouldn't that be great? And we did. We went out to the wholesale produce market in the Bronx. A guy who owned a dried fruit and nut place next door to our apartment said, oh yeah, just go out to the Bronx, they'll have those, you know, sun-dried Valencia's from New Mexico, and we brought them back to the apartment, boiled them up, and they were so good.
And the smell, the fog of
just brought you memory back,
and
memories. And
yeah,
of,
brought back memories, and we thought, you know what, there must be other homesick Southerners like us who need, you know, who crave boiled peanuts. And we we sort of, that was the genesis of business. We sort of started the business before we actually were in business. We just floated a press release to the New York Times saying, boiled peanuts now available by mail order. And they ran with it. Florence Fabricant. What was it, June 1st?
June 1st, 1994. Little paragraph with our, you know, tenement department phone number, and that thing lit up at 5 a.m. And
no, you got to be concerned. So no friends at the New York Times did that for you. That was just the press release.
Oh,
they
were
just interested in
this. Is what we always tell to, you know, chefs or people in the food business trying to get a start. It's like, don't underestimate the power of 8.5 by 11, you know, just an honest, like, sheet of paper with your, you know, plea on it and your name signed at the bottom. Like, that can reap dividends even in this day
and
age.
Did open the door for you later on to write freelance for the New York Times. You had a sort of connected
one. No, that complicated it. Absolutely.
All right, let's take a break and then we'll find out how the boiled peanuts complicated the entry of the Lee brothers into writing about food for the New York Times. Matt and Ted and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Matt and Ted Lee. They got a lot of friends here in Chapel Hill, but they're back traveling around to promote their new book, Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen. And we're talking about how they got into this business. And I don't want to take all of my time talking about this history, but this is really quite interesting about how boiled peanuts got started and then how it led to a career in writing. All right, so you've hit the jackpot, or you've hit the lights. The lights on the telephone are lighting up.
Yes, 1994, we got our reason for being because we tapped into this vein of expatriate Southerners around the country who craved boiled peanuts and were willing to pay $4 a pound for them. Instead of $1, which is like the street price back in 1994, back in Charleston, where we grew up. So, and the interesting thing is these people hungry for boiled peanuts also wanted Duke's mayonnaise, stone ground grits, artichoke relish, whole fig preserves,
all these things, cheer
wine soda.
Find.
And so you see this whole portfolio of regional, special, locally associated products comes to mind. And so we thought, well, let's make a catalog out of it. Let's go back to Charleston, which we did that summer, and set up in a little old hotel room on Broad Street. And that's where we are today, doing about the same thing, which is sending out a little catalog. It's now on the web, of course, boiledpeanuts.com. But we ship, you know, every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, fresh boiled peanuts around the country.
Well, that is really interesting. And it's interesting to me that it comes in the context of Southern Seasons here, planning to open a store in
You don't
Charleston.
Know how excited we are about
Are you excited
this.
Or threatened
yes.
by it?
Oh, not at all. No, this is a watershed moment for Charleston. You know that Charleston is so much in the food discussion these days, mostly because of the restaurant culture. But we feel that it's the home cooking culture that is just as worthy of scrutiny and just as exciting to engage in. And Southern Season is a way for people, you know, millions of people, to engage Charleston food through the ingredients, through cooking classes, through, you know, just getting more happy
so
about home
Charleston
cooking.
Cooking to Charleston people in a way that it's been in the restaurants and now it's
a catalyst. You know, a place like Southern Season at that scale just gets you, whoever you are, excited to cook at home. And that's a great thing for Charleston.
Wow. Well, writing for the New York Times, then for Travel and Leisure, then you're writing for all kinds of other people, kind of it's exploding. when did you say, okay, hey, let's do it. Let's write our own book.
It was actually, we did a talk at the New York Public Library about regional Southern food, probably in about 2002.
It was a panel discussion. We were just...
It was a panel discussion, and an editor from W.W. Norton was in the audience at that, and she was the one who really, you know, sort of collared us and said, you got to write a cookbook. Because we had thought we were going to write an essay book, you know, about essays devoted to Southern ingredients like country ham, stone ground grits, things like that. And then we thought, you know what, we've got so many recipes, because by that time we'd been writing for the Times for a couple of years, and mostly about Southern subjects, like we'd done a reappraisal of lard, we'd done a story on shrimp burgers, you know.
Stone ground grits revival.
Stone ground grits revival. You know, we basically sent a list of pitches to the Times in 1999 or 2000. It was 12 ideas, and they This was out of the blue, completely cold, scentless.
Another 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper.
No
personal contact yet. I mean, by now you've got buddies there. See, this is this goes against everything that I advise people like you about how to get in. That is build a network of friends.
Well, we don't advise people to go our route either.
We probably took the long route, but.
I mean, we are still freelance writers and boiled peanut sellers, you know, 2 decades in. So what does that say?
So this was terrible way that you handled it.
Yes.
And made contact with the publisher who wanted what you...
How far we've come, because at that time we sent them these 12 ideas that we wanted, and they said, oh gosh, we haven't even heard of 8 of these things from the South, so yes, do them.
But now they had to be convinced... Also, that you had the didn't they? This is a question mark. That you also had the ability to write something.
Once you get that first lucky break, that you know the Travel and Leisure South Carolina story, then we've got our clip.
So they
have all the reassurance
to this
they need.
8.5 by 11 inch. Exactly. You clipped your article
exactly.
in Travel and Leisure.
Yeah.
And that was enough to tell them, okay, other editors have worked with these guys.
It wasn't a total disaster. So, Pete, you know, at the publications, whether it's newspaper or magazines or whatever it is, even blogs, you know, people are hungry for good stories. And as long as this is what we counsel other aspiring freelance writers, deliver those editors a story they haven't seen before, a new twist, something that gets them excited. You know, they are the most blasé people. They have seen it all. And so if you deliver them some kernel of something that feels fresh, they will be so grateful to you that they won't care what your credentials are, that you don't need to go to Columbia Journalism School. You don't need to, you know, prove yourself. Just prove yourself by delivering some fresh and delicious ideas.
Have something new bolstered by some kind of assurance that you can... write about something new in a way that's interesting.
Well, that's right. The pitch itself, that 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, really, you know, important. There shouldn't be a word out of place in those two paragraphs.
Yeah.
It should be as fresh and as lively as your long-form prose should be.
Well,
of course, nowadays, most magazine writing, at least, is very short form.
Well, how did the magazine and New York Times writing... Get to the publisher who heard you guys talk at the public library in New York.
I guess you must read the New York Times, but you know that's the wonderful thing. If you can write for a national platform, you know you're not reaching even 2 million people. You know, Martha Stewart Living Magazine, plenty of people can miss out on that, but. You know, over time, over a few years, you can pretty much assure that your byline gets out there. And so I presume she found out about it through the Wednesday dining section.
And so she called you and said, hey, guys, why don't you write a cookbook?
Yeah.
And then you said, well, we don't write cookbooks. We write essays. And then how did the conversation go?
No. We hooked up with a wonderful agent, David McCormick, book agent, who had never done a cookbook before. We love to reinvent the wheel. I think you can tell that. So we went with David, and he's the one who, you know, made her prove that she was interested in our
by,
you know, Southern cookbook.
Money or what?
Yes, well, by, you know, competing with what he does is he grabs other people who are also interested.
He took her idea.
It wasn't her idea.
Well, it was. She said she's the one who said cookbook.
She's the first person to express an interest as plainly as she did. But David found others who were also just
so. You were able to get an agent who could establish a bidding interest among several publishers.
That's right.
Made you guys rich on the spot.
Well, no, but unfortunately, she was the one who was the most interested, because she had a lot to teach us about the cookbook making process, which has carried through our entire careers to the point where so now we are teaching other authors. We have a little cookbook boot camp now in Charleston.
Oh, well.
We started in January, where we are taking aspiring cookbook authors, mostly chefs, through the process in an intensive 2-day period. Teaching some of the things she taught us about how you write a quality recipe for a mass audience, because it's a very difficult thing to really make what you do in the kitchen translate to other people in other kitchens.
Well, you guys, every time I start getting back on track towards talking about your new book,
we drop another bomb on you.
Charleston Kitchen. You throw, it's like you're hunting, like you're fishing for crabs, and you're throwing another chicken overboard for me to grab at. But I'm going to take a break, try to get back on track, and we'll continue our discussion with Matt and Ted Lee. This time, I'm headed towards a discussion and promotion of their latest book, Lee Brothers, Charleston Kitchen. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I've got a resolution. So many interesting things about these two guys. But, I mean, you guys came to promote the book, so promote the Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen.
You know, a lot of people, you know, this is really the book we feel we grew up to tell, you know.
This is back into essays as well as recipes, and a combination.
Recipes, and we truly feel that we owe Charleston everything, because it was really growing up in the Charleston food culture that made us interested and made us want to dig deeper into its culture. You know, our first book was called The Lee Brothers Southern Cookbook, and it was very much about regional Southern cooking and to sort of get the message out to people that you really couldn't just say Southern cooking. You had to talk about whether you were in the Appalachian South or whether you were in New Orleans, and really show people, a mass audience, that we cook differently from place to place in the South. It's not just fried chicken and barbecue. The second book was Simple Fresh Southern, and it was a lighter take. We wanted to show people that, you know, we cook from day to day in a style that we feel is very Southern, but is easy preparations, fresh ingredients. In this book, we get to go back to where we're from and really tell the stories of friends there who make our cooking and writing lives and dining out lives so delicious. And it was really fun. We knew that we knew a lot about Charleston food just from having grown up there. But we also, in this book, we didn't want to take anything for granted. And so we really probed, we worked harder. You know, we have a friend, for example, we have a friend, Fred Docker, who's a crabber. And he's just a great guy.
He's a waterman. He has waterman. Crab pots, but he also trolls for shrimp and does things seasonally.
And there's a minor conch market and things like that. And, you know, we've always picked up our crabs at the dock on Soligree Road from him directly. But doing this book, we had the time to actually go out on his boat with him and spend the day with him and see what his day is like. And, you know, when you do that, it was like a 42 degree day. We've got our hats on, all our winter gear. You realize, you know, it gives you a special window into his life and what that's like, but also his relationship to the blue crab. You know, he's the one who taught us so much about crab roe and why it's so important in a she crab soup, from a flavor perspective and color and how you spot the roe and the crab.
How to purchase it.
And,
so does he? Is that typical that a fisherman or a waterman not only goes out and gets his catch, but that he becomes a special kind of expert about how it might taste better or what parts of it might be?
He's a specialist.
He's the source.
He's the source. And he was telling us how he has two children, and one of them, the 14-year-old, likes the Jimmy crabs, the male crabs that are big and tough. And his daughter likes the sooks, the ones with roe, because she thinks they taste different. You know, the Jimmy crabs are like too forceful of flavor, and she likes them.
I said, now you're talking about wines, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. But you get that perspective. Like, you know, they wouldn't view it as sort of wine connoisseurship. It's just what they like. They know what they like. But to us, it's like, wow.
So you all grew up in the midst of all of this, mm-hmm. but that these visits for this book enhance your understanding and appreciation of the diversity of flavors from what were for me, I'm just trying to figure out whether crab meat is fake or real when I buy it at the grocery store.
Yeah, is it from this country or from Indonesia?
Yeah.
Yeah, we spent 3 years making the Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen, and fully two of them was really the research. I mean, we sat down with funeral home directors. We rode around on the U.S. Foods truck delivering to the back doors of these Charleston restaurants. We, you know, interviewed the guy who's the shad fillet expert in the, you know, cutting room at Crosby Seafood. We, you know, followed every lead. There's this restaurant on Shem Creek called The Wreck, which is a great source for fried seafood. And their deviled crab on the menu says deviled crab by Henry Schaffer. And it's something we'd never questioned.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Okay, there's some guy. Well, you know, this was our opportunity to find out. Well, we sat down and watched as he packed the deviled crab, and he led us to many other stories besides. Turns out he was the grandson of the founder of Henry's Restaurant, the iconic 20th century Charleston restaurant. So a lot of... The cool thing is Charleston is like that. One thing leads you to another. It has this looping, interconnected, you know, old school fabric, and it's very easy to get bundled up into it. And we wanted the book itself to have the to sort of, you know, drag you into that a little bit. So characters that appear in one story, one recipe, might come back in another later in the book.
I want to again jump off track for just a second from your book, but the challenge that you give to people like me who kind of sit around and maybe we go to different restaurants and have dining experiences, but you're suggesting that even here in Chapel Hill in Orange County, there are stories like that for us to find, if not a book full of them, one or two, you know.
And absolutely. But, you know, it's back to our original trick. You know, how do you find raw peanuts in Manhattan? You know, solve that and you will find the stories. You know, you go to the sources. Folklorists, we found in our, you know, sort of travel food writing, the folklorists are a great source of information. You know, agricultural equipment dealers are a great source of information on who's doing what food related. You know, they don't see food the same way hungry folks do. It's part of their business. But still they can inform on the blueberry farmers around and stuff like that. So you can find your way in.
Chefs all over are you know, they're good at finding those stories. I mean, I think of in this area, Bill Smith and Seasoned in the South, Andrea Rusing's book, Cooking in the Moment, they're filled with stories.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Like their raw materials.
Well, I love you're doing this because you're coming back and saying, we got the experts from Charleston. So we appreciate you. You all are celebrities. And then you're saying,
I think Fred Dockery, the waterman we were talking about in Charleston, was a graduate student at Duke.
Is that right?
And put that aside to go into business for himself. Yeah,
do what he really loves. What is your experience in digging up these stories? I think many of us, if we go into a restaurant, the chef is busy. Mm-hmm. I mean, during mealtime, the chef would be nice and cordial, come out and make his pitch, but he didn't have time to sit down and visit with you about where he gets his food. So you got to come back some other time. How do you seduce chefs into giving you coffee time?
It's not just chef stories that are here. I mean, certainly chefs have been so generous to us in explaining their process. And, you know, we borrow a lot of, we get inspired by every time period. So we're just as inspired by a contemporary chef doing something cool in Charleston as we are by, you know, sitting down with Sarah Rutledge's Carolina Housewife and looking at a recipe for salsify oysters and being like, wow, what is that? We got to figure out what that is.
Which we did, by the way.
It's also partly about what Matt was saying is sort of showing you care and showing an interest and just presenting it as, you know, I know you're a busy person. I'm interested in this. Like, let's meet at a time where we can make it happen. Like, a classic example is the guy who debones shad for Crosby Seafood, which is a fish market on Spring Street in Charleston. I mean, this guy is like a genius. Maybe the only guy on the East Coast who can debone a shad, which is famously bony, in like 3.5 minutes. And so he makes shad filet available to Charleston.
And affordable. Oh, if it took him half an hour, it wouldn't be affordable anymore.
He's got labor saving, time savings.
His main job. He's a longshoreman in the port of Charleston. So he just does this Crosby's thing to pick up extra money when he can. And he is so hard to track down. And so, you know, we sort of had to approach Crosby's and say we wanted to interview him. And it was this sort of do-si-do. And, but fundamentally, you know, when you sit down with him, he has so much knowledge to share. And if you acknowledge that, you know, from the start and say, I want to do this on your time, you know, you're the one who's busy. You're the one who's...
So this is interesting, and I think this is a real important part. As part of interviewing and conversation, that so many of us feel like in order to have a good conversation, we have to overwhelm the other person with what we know and what... you know, how important we are, and that the real trick is, and what people who have this knowledge are really looking for is somebody who's really interested in them and what they do.
Yes. You have to be a good listener, and you have to give some tell to them that shows you're on the same page, that they don't have to dumb down or
I'm not
soft
interested
pedal
in
what
everybody.
They're
I'm
say.
Interested in you and what you do, and I know enough about what you do to know
right.
that
you have
I want to
indicate
know
that you're sort of meeting them halfway. That you know, well, you know your way around a crab trap.
We're still trying to talk about the Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen. The Lee Brothers' newest book, and it's leading us down many interesting pathways. We'll continue the discussion after this short break. We're talking with Matt and Ted Lee about their new book, The Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen. And I'm so excited about the kinds of things that you've introduced me to about me. And we're talking about shad. And now move from Charleston to North Carolina, and there's a tradition of shad going up the out from on our coastal and then coastal plains waters. And shad used to run during this season right now. And so a couple of weeks ago, we made a special trip down to the Cypress Grill in Jamesville, where they're only open during shad season. Right. And they you know, everybody who wants to do all there is to do in North Carolina wants to make a visit to this little dump where they're serving this. So we went there, got the shad, and we said, well, how the shad running? And they said, we don't have any shad anymore. We have to go to South Carolina to get our shad. So it's so the tradition remains, but and so here's the question. I mean, you're talking about the rich diversity of marine life in Charleston, but all of this across the world is threatened, isn't it? By
it is, and you know, we spoke with, as part of our interviews, fisheries biologists and DNR scientists. One guy, Billy McCord, who actually spent most of his career down in Savannah studying the shad fishery, and it's one of the most important issues in you know, seafood aware people on the East Coast. And one of the things we highlight in the book is mahi is one of the species that, because it's so biologically quick, it comes to sexual maturity in 3 years. It grows to, like, you know, huge marketable size in less than that. It's harder for man to interrupt that life cycle, and it proves to be one of the most sustainable, you know, wild fish on the menu these days.
But we also interviewed a guy who, a great guy in Charleston who serves a lot of the restaurants. It's Abundant Seafood. His name is Mark Marhefka, and he's a fisherman who's really, you know, changing the way that chefs approach fish, and he's pushing fisheries that are abundant, like triggerfish, wreckfish. You know, he's responsible for putting them on the menu of Charleston restaurants, and now we see them in restaurants in New York, and sort of taking fish who don't have a name and are abundant, and, you know, they usually have a name that's unappealing, and some
give them a new name if they can.
And not give them a new name, but just get us over that hump, And he also has a sustainable fish community-supported agriculture. I mean, his community-supported fishery. And he really drives into the hands of his customers fish that they wouldn't ever consider, but fish that are sustainable and, you know.
Couldn't be fresher.
Well, all right, well, we've just got a minute or two left, and so I want to, I really do want to meet my obligation to talk about the book. And
Can we talk about another figure who appears in the book?
Oh, yeah, no, I was going to say favorite story or two from the book.
So Edna Lewis, you may recall, I know she cooked at Fearington House. She had a wonderful career in New York, but she actually did about 3 or 4 years in Charleston as the chef at Middleton Place Plantations Restaurant. You know, it's a foundation and tourist site and beautiful gardens, and they have a restaurant there. And it sort of escaped Charleston because to us, Edna Lewis is the godmother of modern Southern cooking. You know, she's the first to just put out there that Southern cooking is elegant, you know, sophisticated, worth studying, and yeah, and the simplicity of it, you know, in a sea of like fancy French food, you know, her voice was distinct. So we went to Middleton Place, which has an archives, looking for menus, some, you know, vestige of her time in Charleston that we could sort of amplify or you know, dig deeper into. And we didn't find much. They had some articles written about her. And we were able to find a really cool photograph of her at Middleton Place that we were able to get permission to republish. But the oral histories about her time there were interesting, and it inspired a recipe in our new book for flounder in parchment with shaved vegetables.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, such a neat thing to hear about from people who had tried it there, what it was like and how long it took to emerge from the kitchen. Because, of course, she would not begin shaving the vegetables till the order came in. And so it took naturally about 45 minutes for her to deliver this dish. But what we would do to get that dish today.
Well, you can get it.
I'm sure we can.
No, I mean, because...
But not from her.
You told us how to do it.
That's right. We've done an homage to it. We don't know exactly how she did it, but we can pretty much iterate from her cookbooks and the way she cooked, how she might pull that off.
You figured out how to do it, didn't you?
Yeah, pretty much. But it's not might have had a pinch of this or a pinch of that.
Yeah. And is it one of those things that you do once in a lifetime?
No, absolutely not. It couldn't be easier. And this parchment technique is so out of favor now, but it seems so 1980s. But it's a wonderful technique. And once you master it, once you have the parchment, once you don't worry about folding it too neatly or correctly or anything, it's yours. And you can run with it on even a Tuesday night.
How about you, Ted? You got a favorite? Another favorite?
Oh, gosh, another favorite from the book. Well, I think, you know, the classic pickled shrimp. There's a pickled shrimp in here that I'm really proud of. It's a citrus pickled shrimp, and it has fennel in it, which we don't think of as a common southern ingredient, but it grows like crazy in the low country. And also we found from studying market reports from the 19th century that it was pretty common in Charleston market, along with vegetables like salsify, pineapples from Cuba,
The diversity of the fruits and vegetables in Charleston is a constant. We, of course, love this season because of all the citrus that's just tapering off, the winter citrus, tapering off just as the spring greens and everything comes up.
And asparagus. Mount Pleasant, just north of Charleston, across the Cooper River, was the asparagus-growing capital of the U.S. around the turn of the century.
Until California came online.
Yeah, a lot of things moved west from, but now, in Charleston, your book is a celebration in many respects of our heritage and our past, mm-hmm. but the cuisine in Charleston and in other places adapts to what's going on
today. Absolutely.
And so, do you celebrate that as well? You celebrate the new things, too.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing we wanted to remedy with this Charleston book was not to attach any specific value, higher value, to any period in the past because, you know, the highest compliment you can pay Southern cuisine is to consider it a living, evolving, breathing organism. You know, it's not something under glass in 1944. You know, that was not the heyday, even though, you know, Grandma was cooking great stuff back then, but, you know, today is the brightest day.
Is this your motto that today is the heyday?
Well, tomorrow might be the brightest day, but today's pretty damn good. And we're looking forward to tomorrow because, you know, we have so many more things at our disposal now and so many more ingredients and fresher ingredients. In some ways, today is a better day for home cooking than it was 20 years ago because of the awareness that we all now have about, you know, different varieties of, you know, heirloom grains and vegetables and animals and things like that that just weren't in the discussion a couple decades ago.
Well, thanks to Matt. And thanks to Ted for getting us excited about not only the Charleston heritage, but our own heritage and the opportunity that we have to enjoy the bounty that God and progress has provided us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, DG. Always a pleasure.
It's been great to visit with the Lee Brothers about their latest book, The Lee Brothers Charleston Kitchen. Thanks to you for listening. This is DG Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.